Well, good evening, everyone. It's a blessing to be out with you all again this afternoon. I look forward to joining you all again after Brad messaged me asking if I was interested in this march, and definitely was. And thankfully, this year, I actually got to bring my whole family with me, so hopefully I can introduce you later to them if you haven't met them already. They're all healthy this year, which is great. So here in a moment, we'll be reading out of Obadiah. And like I said, it's just a blessing. I thank you for the opportunity here. I'm hoping as we dive into the book of Obadiah that we can draw for some lessons that can help us in our own lives. I'll give you all a moment to get there. Obadiah, prophecy in the Old Testament. It's easy to miss. It's only one chapter in the book, and you can fact check me on this, but I'm pretty sure it's the shortest book in the Old Testament. And the book of Obadiah covers two nations at odds, Edom, the nation of Edom, and the nation of Israel. And specifically in the context of Obadiah, it appears that Judah is specifically under attack by Edom. And based on the reading that we just had in Numbers chapter 20, we could see these two nations have been at odds with each other for a long time. Even back during the time of Moses, during the reading in Numbers chapter 20, as Israel's trying to travel into their land, they're trying to pass through, and Edom says no. And that really is a kind of a hallmark of the relationship. It was tense all the way from the very beginning. If you go to the beginning of these two nations, the nations come from two twin brothers, Jacob and Esau. And Esau, the older of the twins, was born first, but as we see in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 26, Jacob was born second, but he was born holding on to the heel of Esau. So ever since birth, these two nations have been at odds with each other. And so that brings us to Obadiah. Why should we study this prophecy? So if you've spent time there, great. If not, that's okay too. Hopefully we can get a lot out of it. While it is the smallest book in the Old Testament, I think it addresses one of the biggest problems that we can see in our society today and maybe in ourselves in general. It addresses the problem of pride. And it shows not just what pride looks like, but also what problems pride can create in our own lives, among other things. So my goal and what I'm hoping as we get out of this study that we can dig in, see the application that this prophecy provides, not just to the people at the time, but also into our own lives today and see what applications we can make. We'll start in verse 1 of Obadiah. The vision of Obadiah. This is what the Lord God says concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations, saying, "Arise and let us go up against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised, and the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. The one who lives in the clefts of the rock, on the heights of his dwelling place, who says in his heart, 'Who will bring me down to earth?' Though you make your home high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. Would they not steal only until they had enough? If grape pickers came to you, would they not leave some gleanings? Oh, how Esau will be searched, and his hidden treasure searched out. All the people allied with you will send you to the border, and the people at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. Then they who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. There is no understanding in him. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, eliminate wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Esau? Then your warriors will be filled with terror, timon, so that everyone will be eliminated from the mountain of Esau by murder. Because of violence to your brother Jacob, shame will cover you, and you will be eliminated forever on the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem. You too are as one of them. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah on the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast on a day of their distress. And do not enter the gate of my people on the day of their disaster. You indeed do not gloat over their catastrophe on the day of their disaster. And do not lay a hand on their wealth on the day of their disaster. And do not stand at the crossroads to eliminate their survivors. And do not hand over their refugees on the day of their distress." Now, it makes me a little nervous that we read through most of the book and only like 5 minutes of the lesson, but we'll work with what we have here. Starting verse, the first couple of verses, the first two verses, it talks about what is going to happen to Edom in the vision of Obadiah. It says, that there's been a report in them among the nations. Let us go up against her for battle. Make you small among the nations, greatly despised. So we see battle, made small, made to be despised. Reading this without context, you may say, wow, this is a lot for one nation for punishment. What did they do to deserve all that? And then we really get down to the heart of the matter in verse 3. It says, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. So from what we're reading here, Edom was pretty sure of themselves. And at least from a physical perspective, they might have had a good reason to be confident in themselves. If you have ever time to look up images, and I apologize, I wanted to bring images and I didn't assemble them. But if you ever had time to look at Mount Seir and the location where they believed the Edomites existed, south of Israel, south of Judah, that region isn't the most friendliest place on earth, right? There's wilderness there, there's rocky terrain, there's a desert terrain, there's just mountainous areas. There's some sections of the land where they believe they lived that they sit at 5,500 feet in elevation, so just a really tough area. Now, by a show of hands, who has ever been to a state park like Turkey Run or something similar? Has anyone been out there? Okay. So just to give you perspective, some of our state parks like Turkey Run, their trails range from anywhere to 147 to 700 feet and changing of elevation. So compare that, 700 being the max in some of those state parks, to 5,500 feet, right, from where we live and our locale to the location of Edom. You know, after I hike a trail and I go out to a state park, I just have a hard time getting to the picnic table for lunch, right? How hard would it be for someone to hike a mountain range, you know, 5,500 feet to then go battle somebody? And so that's part of where Edom gets some of their strength and some of their stability is from a physical perspective. They sat at a really good place in terms of being protected from enemy nations. It'd be very difficult for someone to storm their kingdom. So that's one aspect of maybe where their arrogance was sourced from. What does God say to that? In verse 4, though you make your home high like the eagle, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. And all their defenses and all their calculations and their locale of their cities and their kingdom, there's one thing the Edomites did not take into account, one variable they forgot, and that's God. And in this imagery, we see this mental image that Edom had of themselves, and they're just so high. You know, they're like the eagle, right? They're high in the sky, nothing can touch them, nothing can reach them, but they didn't consider God. And God was going to bring them back down to earth. And this is where I really want to dig into and talk about the idea and the concept of pride. With pride, there's a key aspect of it, and that's forgetting God. And I believe that comes from believing we don't even need God, right? You believe so much in your position that you decide you don't even need him from where you're at. And that idea can come from, I can depend on myself, my wealth, my skills, my, you know, fill in the blank. And take a moment just to reflect on our own culture today. Don't we have some of those issues maybe in our society? Some of that built into what we think and how we process things? You know, look at my degree. You know, look at my wealth, my house, you know, my vacation home. I'm a go-it-alone person. I'm a self-made man or a self-made woman. You know, some of these things, you know, they sound, you know, invigorating, encouraging, right? Oh, I'm a self-made man. That sounds great. But, you know, I'd much rather be known as a God-molded man than a self-made man or woman, right? To be formed and molded and guided by God rather than going it alone in life, because we don't have to go it alone. And we'll get more into that here. Circling back to the Edomites here in Obadiah, what did they take pride in? So obviously we can see they had some strength in their position and their location and their physical location where they lived in the mountains. But what else? What else did they have? In verse 8, it says, will I not on that day, declares the Lord, eliminate the wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Esau? And apparently, from what we can read here and from what we can understand in secular history, the people of Edom had some acknowledgement as being of having wise people among their numbers. Teman, a location, a city, a population center of Edom, is mentioned as verse nine, and it's mentioned in the next verse, in verse 9, which makes me think that that could have been a location of where some of their wise men were located at. And so they were a hub of people that had some smarts about them. You know, admittedly, before this, I had a mental image, and I think this might have come from knowing about the story of Esau and how he's compared to his brother Jacob and how he lived out in the wilderness. He was a hunter. I just assume, you know, that's all an Edomite is, right? They're just like Esau. But in reality, now that was centuries earlier, right, in their history, that in reality, they actually had a lot of development. I don't know if you've ever seen some of the places, and, you know, there's National Geographic, History Channel, or whatever, but in that region of Mount Seir, they had a lot of development. I don't know if you ever watched the movie Indiana Jones 3, but in the city of Petra, it's like a palace cut into the stone of a rocky mountainside, and that's actually kind of in the territory of Edom. And so you have these people that know how to build, how to construct. Leah and I, we watched a documentary of groups that lived in that area where Edom was at, and they had figured out how to make stone basins that could collect water and wells that could naturally collect rainwater, because it's not a very dry region, and so they could collect water when there was rainstorms, and so that's how they were able to be sustained in a desert area. And I could keep going on about different things. They had, the history shows and archaeology shows, they had a really highly developed a smithy and metallurgy and all kinds of things, whether it's crafts or arts or whatever. They were developed in that region. At least that's what we can see in archaeology. But the big picture here, wisdom is great. It's an amazing thing. But it's not the end-all be-all, is it? If you keep a finger in Obadiah, we're going to go slip over in the New Testament and go to 1 Corinthians. First Corinthians in chapter 1 and verse 19. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the understanding of those who have understanding I will confound. Where is the wise person? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has God not made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was pleased with the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. And here, Brother Paul and the Corinthian brethren, he's speaking to them about Jesus Christ and how really confusing to a lot of different individuals. But the idea there that's being expressed is that man in all his wisdom doesn't hold a candle to God and his wisdom and his planning and his understanding. And so despite that being one big thing that we can see in the people of Edom and what they leaned on and what they had amongst themselves, next to God, it wasn't worth anything. And let's go back to Obadiah. Let's go back. So they had good territory. They had the people, the smart people to run the territory. What else did they have? Obadiah in verse 7 and also in verse 9, we see they had allies in verse 7 of other nations, people that surrounded them. We also see in verse 9, they talked about them having warriors. And so they have people to defend their strong territory. They have strong neighbors. But while we read in these verses, God says, don't depend on them. And it says that their nation just had overconfidence, not just in their own strength, but in their relationships with those who were around them. Also here, in verse 6 and verse 17, it talks about Edom having treasure, hidden treasure. Verse 17 talks about them having property. It doesn't appear that Edom was a poor country by any means. Based upon these verses and what we can see in, like I said, in secular history and talking about the region, archaeology, and what they've dug up, you know, this location of Edom actually laid in a path, the King's Highway, which we actually I think read in Numbers chapter 20, the King's Way. They were actually in a location that should have been, some of their major population centers should have been on the path of trade routes between several different nations. And so there is a potential there for them to gain great wealth amongst their everything else that they had, right? And so if we just add all this up, Edom had the location, they had the people to run it, they had allies, they had warriors, they had treasure, they had property. The self-made Edomites, right? They're doing really good from a physical perspective. But there's one thing they didn't lean on, and that was God. And I thought it was interesting, the first song we sang this afternoon was Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, right? That's a concept that they didn't understand and they didn't do. And what really stuck out to me, just backing up to Obadiah in verse 3, says the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. And I really want to focus in on that concept, which I think is scary in my opinion, is when this deception doesn't come from some outside party, someone pulling the wool over your eyes, but you've actually pulled the wool over your own eyes. You've been self-deceived. You've done it to yourself. You've confused yourself. That kind of deception is quite terrifying, because they are quite sure of where they stood, where they thought they found a path of success. And that reminds me of Proverbs 16, verse 9. The mind of a person plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. Losing track of who's in charge, where all the good things come from. And this self-deception that Edom exhibits, that Obadiah in his vision is warning them against, is not just limited to the Edomites. We actually see that apply throughout the history listed in the Bible of all these other nations, where they became deceived, where they thought they didn't need God. They ignored his prophets, and they just went on their own way. And one specific warning I want to draw out is in Deuteronomy chapter 8. So if you could, again, keep a finger in Obadiah. Let's slide over to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 8, and we'll start in verse 11. And this is Moses. He's warning, he's teaching the people of Israel. And realize the nation of Israel has gone through a lot up to this point. And Moses is just giving them some reminders and then some lessons and some instructions and some warnings of what's to come when they enter into the land, of the promised land. So starting in verse 11, "Be careful that you do not forget the Lord your God by failing to keep his commandments, his ordinances, and his statutes, which I am commanding you today. Otherwise, when you eat and are satisfied, and you build good houses and live in them, and when your herds and your flocks increase, and your silver and gold increase, and everything that you have increases, then your heart will become proud, and you will forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. He who led you through the great and terrible wilderness, with its fiery serpents and scorpions, and its thirsty ground where there was no water. He who brought water for you out of the rock of flint. In the wilderness it was he who fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, in order to humble you, in order to put you to the test, to do good for you in the end. Otherwise you may say in your heart, 'My power, my strength, and my hand made me this well.' But you are to remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you your power to make wealth, in order to confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. And it shall come about, if you ever forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve and worship them, I testify against you today that you will certainly perish. Like the nations that the Lord eliminates from you, so you shall perish because you would not listen to the voice of the Lord your God." I draw some interesting comparisons between the warning that Moses gave to the Israelite nation and also to the study that we're doing here of Edom. And, this idea of just being so blessed, just like Edom was so blessed, and yet in all those blessings and all the good things that came from all the blessings of God, forgetting what is the source of those blessings. In James chapter 1, verse 17, "Every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow." It all comes from God. All the good things come from God. But what happens when you're self-deceived and you think you've made it all for yourself? You forget the source of those blessings. Let's go back to Obadiah. Let's go back to Obadiah, and we'll read in verse 10 here in a second. So we see the people knew not God. They didn't know where the source of their blessings came from. At least we don't see any indication of that here. We see arrogance. We see pride. And where does all this pride and arrogance lead to? In verse 10, it says, because of the violence to your brother Jacob, shame will cover you. And verse 10 through verse 14, we see references of what they did, what Edom did to his brother Jacob, right? To their brother nation next to them. Judah here, and I read different historical takes on this, whether we're looking at an early date of 845 BC, where Judah was going through some hard times there, or if we're going to the final date of the Babylonian invasion of 586. I think I saw more evidence pointing towards the earlier date. I did find it interesting that Jeremiah and Obadiah are referencing each other, so either one came before the other in the reference. But whichever date you go with here, Judah is under duress, now most likely caused by their own sins and their own problems. But what we see here with Edom and attacking his brother country, this is kind of the crux of the matter. With them forgetting their source of their blessing, with them not acknowledging God, with them becoming arrogant and prideful, and this self-absorption, with all this self-absorption, we see no compassion coming out of the Edomites. Not only do they rejoice over someone else's duress, which we see in verse 12, but they rejoice in someone else's destruction, they boast about it. They don't just do that, but they're also participating in the humiliation and the destruction of their brother nation. And the big point I just want to draw out of this is, talking about the self-made man, right? This big person they are. You know, when you're all considering, when you're all self-absorbed with yourself, when everything's about you and all that pride has just made you self-centered, what room is there left for another person in your life to show love or compassion to? You know, there is none. Pride can be the reason why we lose compassion towards our fellow brother, because it's all about me and not about them. And so this is just another aspect of where their arrogance and their sin is leading them to, is the lack of love and compassion towards others. And I think that's just a warning of pride in general. And it might be a significant portion of every sin, that pride has an element to play in that. Let's put our finger again on Obadiah, and we're going to go to James chapter 1, if you want to join me there. We referenced verse 17 earlier, and now we're going to go a few verses down. In James chapter 1 and verse 27, it says, pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our Lord, of our God and Father, is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained by the world. What is pure and undefiled religion? Why is it based at all on widows and orphans? That to me is a little confusing. Until you consider the idea here that orphans and widows at this time, and then also even in our society today, they really show, and they are some of, if not the most vulnerable members of our society, those who don't have a strong protector, at least on this earth. And so these vulnerable members of our society, they need support. They need people to help. And someone without compassion, someone with pride, with self-absorption, those who don't have any room in their heart for another person, may look at a vulnerable individual like a widow or an orphan or somebody else in that position and look at them as a waste of space, a waste of air, a waste and a drain on society. But how does God view them? That's the question. Let's slide over, still in the New Testament, Matthew chapter 25. Considering how God thinks of how he treats and care and consider others, Matthew chapter 25. A well-worn passage, to say the least, but worth visiting again. Matthew chapter 25 and verse 34. The king will say to those on his right, Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. And the righteous ask, when did we do all that? And they repeat all that. And then in verse 40, it says, and the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it for one of the least of these brothers or sisters of mine, you did it for me. How does God view our treatment and consideration and compassion towards our fellow human being? Well, from what we're seeing here, from what Jesus says, it's a centerpiece of how we will be judged at the end of time. So it carries weight. How do we treat others? Does pride get in the way of our compassion and consideration of others? Circling back to Edom, going back to Obadiah. So we see this lack of compassion. We see this arrogance exhibited towards people they should have cared about. And not just, oh, how does that impact me? I don't care what's going on. They actually took advantage of someone who was in a weak stage. They took advantage of someone in their misfortune. Edom did with Israel. So pride shows no regard for others. And we can see that exists in the hearts of those who operate great evil. But what is God going to do about this? And we see in verse 15 what God is going to do. Verse 15 of Obadiah. For the day of the Lord is near for all the nations. Just as you have done, it will be done to you. Your dealings will return on your own head. For just as you drink on my holy mountain, all the nations will drink continually. They will drink to the last drop and become as if they never existed. This judgment is not going to be exclusive to Edom. So we see Edom really here, and actually throughout the Bible, you can actually make some comparisons. Edom really becomes a symbol of all those who oppose God and oppose his people. You know, it's interesting, all the way from Jacob and Esau down to our reading in Numbers chapter 20 to this point in time, all the way to when Herod is seeking out infant Jesus, wanting to put him to death. I didn't realize this until later that I believe Herod actually came from Edomian, which is another term of Edomite, right? So from the beginning to end, there's been the struggle between these two brothers, these two nations, these two people. And it's just symbolic of everyone who is opposite of God and God's people. What is God going to do? There's judgment that is coming towards him, towards Edom and towards all other nations. And there's this idea, says, your dealings will return on your own head. And it's this idea of what's going around is going to come around, right? And this pattern is woven out throughout the Bible. If we wanted to go there, Galatians chapter 6, we see that in the New Testament, right? We reap what we sow, both good and bad. And so that's to me, that's a little intimidating, right? Knowing that whatever I'm doing, whether good or evil, whether showing compassion or being prideful and ignoring those who have needs, will come back to me. Something to be mindful of. But there is positivity in this message. There is hope as we continue on. In verse 17 of Obadiah. But on Mount Zion there will be those who escape, and it will be holy. And the house of Jacob will possess their property. Then the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. But the house of Esau will be like stubble, and they will set them on fire and consume them. So there will be no survivor of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. And those of the Negev will possess the mount of Esau, and those of the Shephelah, and the Philistines' plain. In the Philistine plain, also they will possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria, and Benjamin the territory of Gilead, the exiles of this army of the sons of Israel, who are among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Shebron, will possess the cities of the Negev, and the deliverers will ascend to Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's. I see here a message of hope, hope specifically for God's people. You know, I find it interesting, and this might actually be a lesson on its own, but there's a contrast between two mountains here. The mountain of Esau that we see initially brought up in verse 9, and then the mountain of God, Mount Zion, we see in verse 21. And it's interesting here, in verse 21, which mountain is judging which mountain? It says Mount Zion, right? It stands above the mountain of Esau. And I think there's some great things to be learned here, that even when oppressed by evil, by those who don't know God, those who don't have compassion, those who appear to be in a physically strong position, even when all that's going on, that no matter what's happening there, what position they may be in, that the strong position is the position that has God with it, right? Being on God's mountain, that's the strong position in life. And there's hope there for deliverance from God. And so it's not about being a self-made man. It's not standing alone, not standing on your own strength or what you built up, but standing on God's strong position that he provides to his people. And if you ever just want to, I think this is just a neat study on talking about the two contrasting directions we can take in life, right? Going our own way or going God's way. If you just really want to boil it down, we can go to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and slammed against that house, and yet it did not fall, for it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built on his house on the sand, and the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew, and slammed against that house, and it fell, and its collapse was great. Jesus makes it really clear for us, really straightforward, there are two positions that we can have in life. The strong position that is him and what he provides, and then everything else, anything else that's outside of him. And if you stand outside of Jesus, if you stand outside of God, that your foundation is susceptible to collapse. And so, I hope in conclusion here, the lesson will be yours, as we leave here, and thinking about what pride is, and standing alone from God, and realizing there's no benefit and to trying to go our own way, but we should try to, in every day, in every moment of our life, fully walk with God, stay on his mountain, stay on the strong position that he gives us. Hope something in this lesson has been encouraging to you, or thought-provoking, or at least a reminder, at least it was helpful to me. This evening, if there's something in your life where you realize, I have been going alone, I have been doing things my own way, I need to turn back to God. You know, that's why we're here together. We can encourage each other, try to stay on the strong position together, work together to stay there together. And if you need encouragement from one another, or if you need to get on the mountain, if you haven't become a Christian, if you've not become a child of God, you know, the invitation is always out there. If you know what you need to do, if you know what it means to be baptized, then the opportunity is available to you tonight. Whatever your need might be, please come forward as we stand and sing.